going on me again. I guess Steve means for us to start. I'm Joe Russell. I'm an alcoholic. Welcome, everybody, to the Pine Mountain Fellowship. Gosh, it's getting worse. Anything to improve my image. Steve, just a little bit. I want to see these people. Is it just getting light on that side, or? All right, that's a whole lot better. Yeah, thank you. Welcome, everybody, again, to the Pine Mountain Fellowship. There are some people who were here last night who were here for the first time. Can you see the hands of those people again who are here for the very first time? Wonderful, wonderful. It's real good to have you. How many people are here from out of state? Good, great. Wow. How many people are here from out of the county? Is there anybody here who wants to admit to being from this county? I don't know if y'all had any trouble finding your way to the Pine Mountain Fellowship. Rome S., who's in charge of the buffet tickets, I'm going to tell you about that later. Rome told me about a sign he saw on the way up here. It said, it was on a little Baptist church down the road, and it said, if you're tired of sin, come on in. And somebody had written beneath that, if you're not, call Sally, 322-5111. If you have any announcements that you'd like for me to make, if you'll just see me and make me write it down, I'll make the announcement for you. I want to announce that the Georgia Convention in 85 is going to be in Columbus. And if you'll see Maynard Y., he'll give you one of these, and you can fill it out and give it back to him and won't have to pay any postage on it. Jerry, of course, is taping as we go along, and he'll have the tapes of the meetings ready, what, tomorrow morning? Okay, so tonight's meeting will be ready tomorrow morning, and last night's is already ready. Okay, so just see Jerry about that. Today is Paul Kay's 11th birthday. Anybody else got a birthday today? Anybody else got a birthday today? Okay. All right. Happy birthday, Paul. Paul is your chairman tonight, and Paul used to be in the sales business, and back when he was drinking, he had an appointment that he just didn't feel like he could make. And so he called the guy up, and he said, I'm sorry, I just can't meet with you today. He said, I have laryngitis. And the man said, well, why aren't you whispering? And Paul said, well, hell, it ain't no secret. Paul...
I am Paul Keel, an alcoholic. Hi, everyone. And, of course, I'm sober tonight with the grace of God through this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we'll start in the usual manner, if you will, with the serenity prayer after a moment of silent meditation. Serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Now, for the preamble, Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership We're self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, or organization. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I would like to take just a second to express my gratitude to Lil and to Joe, Dr. Joe, that we all knew that started this fellowship. I've been very fortunate, and this is the 10th meeting that we have made, and each year it gives us the strength to go through another year. We talked about last night the type of year that we'd had the past year, and for the first time, my name was not drawn. So I didn't get a chance to tell you about the past year, but as all my sober years have been, it gets better and better. And I'm just grateful to be here tonight sober. And to get on with the program, I've asked William H. to read for us how it works. I didn't say that I'm a member of the LaGrange group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that that's very important to me. May not be to you, but I think, of course, it's the finest group in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And William is also a member of that group. And someone told our past delegate that if you don't think that your group is the best group in Alcoholics Anonymous, please stay there. Don't get out and louse up another one. And I think that's very good. We go now to our traditions, and we're going to have Bob S. from Tri-Cities. I'll have you a little story to tell you about that group in a minute.
Bob.
Thank you, Bob. Well, the story that I had about the Tri-Cities, those of you in the metro area of Atlanta might are probably familiar with our delegate, Frank R. He's been a member of the Tri-City Group for some time. And he likes to call the Tri-City Group the super group. And I told him that I came into the fellowship in the Tri-City Group back 11 years ago. And served as GSR there. I was starting service work there. And I told him that because of the humility of the program, I can't claim all the credit for the Tri-Cities being the super group, but it is a good group of Alcoholics Anonymous. So take that back to Frankie. He couldn't be with us tonight. I think that my main job tonight is to introduce our speaker. At least that's what I was told. Lil called me 6 weeks ago and asked me if I would chair this meeting and told me who was speaking. And our speaker tonight is a member of the LaGrange Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, so I bumped into him at a meeting, I think, the next night, and I told him that I was going to introduce him, and he had 6 weeks to think of something good I could say about it. And he hasn't got back to me yet. But I think that, really, I don't know how to introduce the man. I've heard his speech. I've heard his story. He shared with us in meeting. And he's a typical American boy, a success story. He was, in his own story, born over in Alabama and moved at a very young age into LaGrange. Attended school there. And after some time, he left LaGrange and went to college and got to be a Baptist minister and returned to LaGrange recently, and since he's been back, he's got his doctorate. So that, it, to me, is a success story. The way that I've heard it, I know he's a success. He's a successful AA. You only have to hear him talk to realize that. So I'm going to let him fill in a few spots that I've skipped, and so I introduce Ray V.
Good
Good evening, everybody. My name's Ray Vowell, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's nice to be introduced after having had to be explained for so many years. I don't know if I was going to tell them I was a Baptist preacher or not. But I guess I am. I really don't apologize for that, you know. I'm no more ashamed of being a Baptist preacher than I am being an alcoholic. They're both incurable. You have to learn. It's a recovery program. And the fact that I was a doctor for my last big punch. See, I thought maybe somebody might want to be examined. I'm not a medical doctor, but, you know, it doesn't matter. I don't charge as much as they do either. I'm a whole lot less expensive. I was reminded, as you were saying that, several years ago, I was invited to speak at the International. I was pastoring a church in Beeville, Texas, and I'm sure you know right where that is. It's between Normanna and Skidmore. And I don't know where that is. That's between George West and Victoria. But anyway, I had a funeral that morning, and the Board of Conference is a very informal type conference. It's a subtropical climate, and, you know, people go down and usually pretty well attended, 1,000 to 1,200 people. And people get down and they get to put on their walking shorts and their Hawaiian flowery shirts and this sort of thing, and they really get laid back, you know. And I had a funeral that morning, and I was late getting off, and so we drove real hard to get down there. And I got there about 15 minutes before the meeting was to start, and I didn't have time to change, and I went running in, and I had on, you know, every preacher has got three suits. He's got a black one for burying, and a light one for marrying, and a brown one for when he's undecided what he's going to do, you know. And I had on my black burying suit, and I went running into this meeting, and this guy was standing by the door, you know, and there's always one by the door, you know, and he said, "What are you, some kind of preacher?" And I said, "As a matter of fact, I am." He said, "What kind of Baptist?" And I said, "As a matter of fact, I am." He said, "You can't be a Baptist preacher and be an alcoholic." And I said, "That's true, but you can be an alcoholic and be a Baptist preacher if you'll be careful to do it in that order." I'm convinced as I stand here tonight that you can be an alcoholic and be anything you want to be if you just do it in the right order. You know, I had an ex-wife who owned a tavern, and they still had a financial relationship in that he was supporting her, and he didn't like to go over there and deliver the check, so he asked me one night if I'd go with him, and we got over, and the place was packed. We sat down over in the corner, and his wife came over, and she said, "You see that guy down at the end of the bar?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am." And she said, "He's a judge." And I said, "See the guy about halfway down there?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "He's a assistant police chief." And then she went on to tell me about all of these prestigious people sitting up there at the bar, you know. And I said, "Lady, I'm not impressed. I used to be all those things when I hung out in places like this, you know." Because that's one advantage. There are very few advantages to being an alcoholic, but one of them is you can be everybody. You know, I used to have friends that come by and say, "Let's go get drunk and be somebody." And I say, "You're not me. I'm not limited. Let's go get drunk and be everybody." You know, I was looking around. You know, it always disappoints me to come to a group like this. I want to thank the committee for inviting me, Lillian. I thank you for being so understanding. The reason I wasn't here last night and I have to leave tomorrow is my first grandchild is here. He's 2 months old, and the smartest, prettiest, most intelligent little boy you have ever seen in your life, and he's leaving tomorrow, and I just can't hardly stay away from him, you know. But, you know, I walked in here this evening, and I looked around, and I said, "They're all here again, the phonies. Not one of you people looks like an alcoholic." I've been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous 13 and a half years. And I don't know how many meetings I've attended, but last year I was invited to speak at the Oklahoma State Al-Anon Convention in Oklahoma City, and I finally met somebody that looked like an alcoholic. It was an Al-Anon. You see, alcoholics, everybody knows what an alcoholic looks like. If you watch movies and watch television, you know what an alcoholic looks like. It's a little old dried up, emaciated, skinny guy that hasn't had a bath in 3 months. He needs a shave. He's long, stringy hair. Smells bad. Sunken eyes. Yellow teeth. You know, this awful looking thing. And I never was like that. I was a big fat guy that hadn't had a bath in 3 months and needed a shave and had hollow, sunken eyes and yellow teeth and all that thing. So I knew that I couldn't be an alcoholic. I was convinced, and I had my wife convinced, that I could not be an alcoholic. In 1971, when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I came in the back door. I came because I had absolutely no place else to go. And I would say to you tonight, in all sincerity, had there been one person on the face of the earth left that I could have told a lie to and made them believe it, I probably would not have come. If there had been one place that I could have borrowed another dime, I would not have come to AA. If there had been one place that I could have gone and made them believe me one more day, I would not have come to AA. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because I had no place else to go. I married a beautiful lady back in 1955. I'm still married to her, and that doesn't say much for her judgment. She's one of those poor, unfortunate ladies that believes that when you get married, you're married for life. She believes that marriage is ordained in heaven and it should be continuous and forever. The only argument that I've won in almost 30 years of marriage is that I'm tremendously smarter than she is. And I've never had any problems proving that, because when she gets upset, I just say, well, look at who you married. I would not have married somebody like she did, I can assure you that. I would not have lived with somebody like she did. And I want to say in defense of the Al-Anons tonight that I know as I stand here, I'm no authority, I'm no expert, but I do know that alcoholism is a family disease and it is contagious, and people who live with chronic alcoholics catch it. And they suffer from it probably more than the practicing alcoholic because they don't have anywhere to put it. And I married a lady who caught the disease of alcoholism. We had a home that she bought with her money and my GI loan. And I thought that made us even. Well, she was working. I had a job. I don't want y'all to think that I was a down-and-out bum. I had a job. I worked for the federal government. I worked for U.S. Public Health Service, and it was easier for them to keep me than it was for them to fire me. And they had decided to make the effort on my behalf. And I was on probation. I lived at home because my wife didn't have the fortitude to run me off. But I lived in the garage. And every Saturday, I don't know if any of you have dogs you keep in the garage and you move everything out on Saturday and hose it out and then put the dog back in there. Well, that's the way I lived. Every Saturday, they moved my bed and my wash tub that I kept my ice in out on the driveway and hosed the garage out. And about once every 2 weeks, they let me in the house to take a shower because the neighbors. I didn't take a lot of showers, folks. I didn't like showers because you know what happens when you get in that shower, your wife will hide your britches every time. And she'll keep them things until the liquor store closes. And I just didn't take showers. When I did, I took my britches in with me. But I'll tell you what, you can catch double pneumonia running to the liquor store at 9 o'clock in a pair of wet khaki pants. So we had a good life going on at our house. Things weren't bad. I hear people talk about they came to Alcoholics Anonymous because things got so bad they couldn't stand it. I had my own garage. I had a car that didn't run. I still had 18 or 19 days before the trial came up. And I was convinced that in God's wisdom, he would let the judge die or the prosecuting attorney would forget, you know. God never did those things. I used to beg him to, and he never did. You know, I used to write checks, and I had no money in the bank and pray that the guy would die before he made the deposit. Never did. They always went through. My wife came out in the garage and said to me, "We have audited you." I was rather proud. I didn't know I had enough to be audited, I'll be honest with you. And I said, "What does that mean?" And she said, "We have figured that it cost us 5 months more to keep you than you bring in. And we can't afford it." I realized then that we had a problem at our house. I decided to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, let me tell you, I knew all about Alcoholics Anonymous. I never had gone because I didn't figure y'all needed my help. I worked in a medical profession. My undergraduate degree was in medical technology. I had worked in hospitals and in surgery. I had worked for doctors all my life, all of my adult life, and I knew all about the problem of alcoholism, and I knew the kind of people who had it, and certainly they weren't like me. And, I mean, after all, I was a property owner, you know. I had clothes. My wife bought me nice clothes. They didn't stay nice long, but I had them. And I realized that she was desperate. And so I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to call them quite frequently because in Irving, Texas, where I came into the program, they have an answering machine. And I loved it. It says, "You have reached Alcoholics Anonymous." Isn't that nice? Isn't that pleasant? "There's no one here at this time." Oh, I love that. Because at this point, I would hang up. Holding the receiver in my hand, I would break the connection and confess to Alcoholics Anonymous. "Let me tell you what I've done today." And like the Pharisees of old in the Bible in Jesus' day, I would confess long and loud, making very sure that my wife heard. And I would pour out the very bottom of my soul to those people at Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't my fault they were not there to hear me. I had tried. And then I would go back in and I would say, "Well, they said maybe I shouldn't drink bourbon anymore. Maybe I ought to drink gin for a while." And she wanted so hard and so bad to believe me that she did. She wanted so desperately to believe that there was just one spark of human decency and good left in me that she would still believe me. And then things would rock along for a little while, and she'd get desperate again, and I'd call AA again. I asked for permission to use her telephone that night. And she said, "For what?" And I said, "I want to call Alcoholics Anonymous." And she said, "Do whatever you want to, just do it somewhere else." And I went in and called AA, and a terrible thing happened. I got a people on the phone. Now, I never cared much for people. People will tell your wife where you've been when you've been gone 4 days. You know, people will call you up from the bank and explain to you that you don't have any more money up there. People will come get your car when you don't pay for it. I've seen them do it at my house. You know, this is not conjecture on my part. I'm telling you, I've seen this with my own eyes. People will laugh at you when you throw up on the sidewalk downtown. Can you imagine that? You're at death's door, and people will pass by and laugh at you. And I'd say, "Yes, you go on. I'll bet you go to church. I'll bet you're a Christian. You don't act like it." I don't know why the man had to say the thing was on the... What was Sally's address? I don't know why that had to be a Baptist church. You know, I'm sick and tired of AA running the Baptist down. We contribute more to Alcoholics Anonymous than anybody. There were two things that used to really irritate me when I first came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to really get irritated, you know, because people would get up and say, I come from a good Baptist home. Somewhere, there is a man who came from a bad Methodist home or a terrible Catholic home. You know, as a matter of fact, there's probably a bad Baptist home somewhere. I don't know where it is. I've never seen it, but I'm sure there must be. And that used to really irritate me. And then another thing was ladies. Lady alcoholics used to just really irritate me. I'm scared of them. You know, I'm terrified of them. They used to get up behind the podium, and inevitably they would say, when I was born, my father wanted a boy. And that's why I am the way I am today. I don't have any sympathy for that. See, I was born in 1934 in the middle of the Depression, and my father wanted a mule. By the time I was 18 years old, he thought he got what he wanted, I tell you that. I got this people on the telephone. And this people said to me, we're having a meeting now. Do you think you could come? And I said, well, I don't know. Could you come if you've been drinking? And he said, most people have. And so I got ready to go to AA. I went in and poured me a glass of whiskey. And my wife said, what are you doing? And I said, the man said, have a drink and come on down there. You see, I learned real early something about alcoholics that you may not know, and that is a physiological fact that the anatomy of an alcoholic is different from most people. And that is that the eardrum and the jawbone don't work at the same time. And the alcoholic can hear anything he wants to hear regardless of what's been said. And if you talk, you don't have to listen. So I got ready, I had a drink, and I went down to AA, and when I got there, they had moved it. It was gone. Now, that wasn't all that unusual in those days for me to call somebody and tell them I was coming. It happened frequently. But I got angry. And I went back home, and I thought, well, my wife surely will understand now that I've made an effort to go to AA, and she'll feel better. She didn't. When I got home, everything that I had was in two pillowcases on the driveway. Well, I didn't know she was that bad off. And I went back and knocked on the door and asked to use the phone, and I called back to AA because I thought by now they'll be gone. And lo and behold, two men were sitting there talking. And I said to them, I think I have a problem. And they said, would you like some help? And I said, yeah, why don't y'all come over here in a couple of days? And they said, if you need some help, we'll come right now. And they did. And I thought what they'd do is they'd come over and tell me I couldn't drink, and I'd whip them both and go on and have a drink. And they didn't do that. They came over and they said dumb things. They came in and one of them said, take it easy. Well, you couldn't take it much easier than I was taking it. I wasn't doing anything. One of them said to me, let go and let God. I didn't have a hold of anything, and if I had, God certainly wouldn't have wanted it. But then one of them said to me, one day at a time. And I understood that. Because, folks, I was already living one day at a time. I couldn't accumulate enough booze to drink 2 days in a row. I drank daily. When I got up in the morning, my entire thought was upon raising enough money somewhere, somehow, to get enough booze for that day. When I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I drank a little better than a quart of whiskey a day. And I had for I don't know how long. I didn't like to, you know, I've never had any problems with the insanity part of the program because I didn't like to buy one bottle of whiskey. I always bought a quart and a half a pint. I like to have a half a pint in my pocket while I drank out of the quart. If you're an alcoholic, you fully understand that, and if you don't, you'd never understand it. If you're not an alcoholic, I couldn't explain it to you because I don't understand it myself, other than the fact that I needed it. And I didn't say I would not do without it, but I needed it. I wanted it. I was a firm believer in Conners. I don't know if any of you are familiar with a Conner. I was a Conner drinker. I drank whiskey out of square bottles, and I have drank a lot of the Conners. That's when you hold it up this way and what's planted across the bottom. That's a Conner. It's not funny if you haven't got but one. Because it takes several Conners to do any good. I found out about Bay Rum hair tonic. Never put any on my hair. But I found out one thing. That if you'll blow in that little hole in the top and hold your tongue over that little hole and take a deep breath and move your tongue, it'll set you free. They say the truth will set you free, but that'll set you free. That'll make your big toenails drunk. You know. And I'm not bragging about that. I'm sharing that with you so that you'll know that I'm qualified to be right where I'm standing. I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And everything got all right, and I never had another problem. I worked the 12 steps the first night I was down there. I went on home, and I told my wife I was going to be on the 12-step list. And I began speaking publicly. My wife and I became deliriously happy. My children were never sad again as long as they lived with us. And we never had another problem, and all my bills were paid, and the bank loved me, and the sheriff forgave me, and the judge was... If you believe all that, I got some land in Florida I want to sell you. I went to Alcoholics Anonymous and sat there every night wasting my time at them dumb old discussion meetings. That's what I did. Terrible. I would sit there every turn thinking about what I was going to say. And then when my turn came, I would say, and I'd spend the rest of the hour thinking about what I had said. And if you don't get anything out of the AA program but what you bring down there, you're probably not going to stay sober very long. And one night a guy said a magic word. He said, sip. Came in and he said, I had a slip. And I'm back. And they hugged him. They kissed his neck. They blowed in his ears. They run their fingers through his hair. They were just barely tolerating me. And I decided, well, the way this thing works is you got to go get drunk and come back, and then they'll love you. But you see, I have a dignity. It's hard to drink with dignity when you're drinking Muscatel. It's almost impossible to drink Aqua Velva with dignity. I remember the first time I realized I had a drinking problem, I was trying to buy a 99-cent bottle of wine with 97 cents. And the man said, you've got a drinking problem. I said, I've got a financial problem. I said, you mean you wouldn't trust me, a man of my standing in the community, for two pennies? I mean, after all, I had on two shoes. They weren't matched. It was about 20 degrees outside, and I didn't have on a shirt, but I thought I had dignity. I always wanted to get drunk with dignity. And so I couldn't just go get drunk. I thought that having a slip meant that one day I'd be driving home from work, and suddenly I'd come drunk. And then I could drink all I wanted to for as long as I wanted to, and nobody could ever blame me again. And so I became a nuisance in our group. And every time we had a meeting and somebody would say, does anybody have anything you want to discuss? I would immediately raise my hand and say, let's talk about slips. One night, a little fellow named Paul Mack. Paul had glaucoma. He weighed about 90 pounds, and he looked at you this way. And he came up to me, and he said, Ray, let's you and I go in the Al-Anon room while these folks have their meeting. I thought, Paul had about 15 years sobriety, and I thought he had a problem. He wanted to... And so we went in the Al-Anon room, and Paul looked at me, standing there squinting up at me like this, and he said, Ray, I've been in AA 15 years. And I want to tell you that, in all sincerity, I believe you're the phoniest SOB we've ever had come down here. And I did what any self-respecting alcoholic would do. I quit. I went home and told my wife they didn't appreciate anything I'd done for them. And terrible logic. And it's always true. Irritating. Works, but it's irritating. And she said, well, why do you think he did it? And I said, he doesn't like me. And she said, well, that's true of most people, but why do you think he does it? And so I called Paul and I said, Paul, why did you do that to me? And Paul said something that woke me up. He said, Ray, we have nothing to share in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous but our experience, strength, and hope, and I've had the experience that you're looking for. And I hope by sharing it with you that you would not have to. He said, now the truth of the matter is, you have lied and boasted and bragged so much in AA that you could never drink in front of anybody. So let me tell you something, you'll have to get some whiskey before you get drunk. And the truth of the matter is, you probably already have, and that irritated me. I didn't know how he knew that. I had a pint of whiskey in the back of my wife's car that I had bought for a poor, suffering alcoholic. Me. And he said, what you'll have to do, Ray, in order to have the slip that you're looking for, you'll have to find a place to drink. And then when you find the place, you'll have to make a decision to open the trunk of the car. You'll have to decide to take the whiskey out. You'll have to decide to open it. You'll have to decide to pour it into your mouth. And then you'll have to decide whether or not to swallow it. And then if you're ever fortunate enough, and you have no guarantee that you will be, to walk into another AA group, you'll have to look them in the face and say, I got drunk. Because I wanted to be drunk more than I wanted to be sober, because that's the only reason. There are no slips. There are planned, executed actions made by alcoholics who make the wrong choice. If that offends you, I don't apologize at all, because it saved my life. I believe what that little old squinty-eyed man said to me. I didn't go into AA. I just didn't believe that you could get drunk with dignity. But I went to meetings. I went to them dumb old meetings. And I talked. Listen, I talked. I talked at open meetings, I talked at closed meetings, I talked at both kinds. I talked at Al-Anon, you know, I talked everywhere. Didn't have anything to say, but I talked. Nothing seemed to help. Carried a big book around. I wore out one big book, carrying it back and forth to the meeting. Never did read it, but I had it. Paul asked me one day, he said, if you got a big book, I said, I'll sleep with it. He said, won't you read it? You don't get much AA by osmosis. I went to them old meetings. One day a fellow come up to me and he said, my name's Al Z and I'm your sponsor. I said, wait a minute, I haven't chosen a sponsor yet. He said, yes, you have, I'm him. I said, I thought you got to pick who you wanted to be a sponsor. He said, you do, you did, and I'm him. I said, well, I'm not sure I want you. He said, you don't understand. Five of us voted and I was the only one that would take it. The only thing that that did is every time I went to a meeting and they'd call on me, I'd say, shut up. I didn't learn anything, but at least I didn't keep the rest of them from learning anything. We only had one meeting that I enjoyed. On Saturday night, we had a beginner's meeting. And I don't know if you've ever been to a beginner's meeting in AA, but it's in Irving Group on Saturday night at 7 o'clock, we'd have a beginner's meeting, and that was for everybody with less than 60 days. And they would get together, and we'd have a meeting so that they'd have time to sweep the BS out before the real meeting at 8 o'clock. And they'd have one old-timer, and he'd sit there, and he'd let us, you know, express ourselves. And a beginner's meeting, it's just fun. It's so enlightening, you know. I've never known anybody stay sober in them, but boy, you enjoy them, you know. collards, you know. You don't get much out of them, but you just get in the habit of eating them, you know. They just lay there and look green, you know. And the beginner's meeting, well, it goes something like this, you know. The first guy will say something like, I used to drink shoe polish. And the next guy said, that's nothing. I used to drink kerosene. Lit. You know, the next guy said, I got drunk one time in Memphis and woke up in Nashville. Next guy said, that's nothing. I got drunk one time in Hong Kong and woke up in Quebec, Canada, in my car. Oh, and then the next thing, there's group waiting for my turn. Well, we had this irritating, bleeding deacon with about 27 years sobriety that I didn't believe had ever had a drink in his life. His name was Curly G, and Curly had 27 years sobriety, or 28, I can't remember which, and he had this irritating habit of smiling at you. And he would say, it or pass. My mama told me that when I was 9 years old and ate prunes. It did, but it was rough. And I wasn't really interested in all that stuff, you know. And Curly had this habit of speaking to a room full of people and looking right at me. And for some reason, I always answered him. And he said, I want to ask you guys a question. Have you ever been so drunk that you didn't remember what you did? Well, I said, certainly. You know, that's a point of honor with an alcoholic. And he said, I want to ask you another question. Have you ever woke up in the bed with a 95-year-old woman with sores all over her body? And I said, I certainly have not. And he said, how do you know? Do you know something? I have never doubted in my wildest dreams that God works in mysterious ways. Because that remark put me square into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked out of that room right then and walked to Al's house 5 blocks away, and I knocked on his door, and when he came to the door, big tears were running down my face. And Al said, what's the matter? And I said, I've just found out a terrible thing. And he said, what's that? And I said, I don't know what I've done. And Al said, none of us do. And I said, I don't care about you and all those others. I'm telling you that I don't know what I've done. And he said, what does that mean to you? And I said, I could never ever again, as long as I live, judge somebody else. Because I don't know what I've done. I can never ever again look down my nose at another human being because I have no concept of what I've done. And Al reached through the door and took me by the hand, and he said, it just might be that you're ready to take certain steps. For the next 12 months, Al was a businessman. He still is. I don't know how much money it cost Al, but for the next 12 months, Al took me to a meeting every day. I got off work at 4:15. Al was at my house at 4:30. He blew the horn one time, and I was either in his car or he came in and we had a private meeting. I was only late once. We drove to meeting. Al would say, what is step one? I said, admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. He'd say, what are the three meanings of AA? I'd say, Alcoholics Anonymous, absolute abstinence, and admitted and accepted that we're powerless over alcohol and our lives have become unmanageable. And he said, what's step two? I said, we came to believe that a power greater than us can restore us to sanity. He said, what does that mean? I'd say, well, that means that no matter how wild we acted, no matter how far afield we got, there is a power somewhere greater than we are that can correct it. And he said, how do you get that power? And I said, we make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And that's the way we went to meetings every night. We'd go into a discussion meeting, they'd call on me, and Al say, he hasn't got a thing to say. Al said to me, you've got two ears and one mouth, and you ought to listen at least twice as much as you talk. You have nothing to say. Some Saturdays, Al would pick me up at 9 o'clock on Saturday morning, and we would attend as many as 8 and 9 AA meetings before we came back home. Sometimes we didn't get home till Sunday. We went to meetings. Al spent hours and hours and hours with me. I remember once that we went to a meeting. All of you have had the joy of this, I'm sure. A fella got up and he said, I don't want to go into a long drunkalog. But I took my first drink in 1924. And by 9:30, he was up to 1946. The next night, we went to another meeting, and the same guy got up. And he said, I don't want to go into a long drunkalog. I got up and left. Al followed me out. And he said, where are you going? I said, I don't want to hear that. He said, let me tell you something. You may not need to hear it. You may not want to hear it, but the man needs to say it. And the very least you can ever learn in Alcoholics Anonymous is tolerance for other people. You come back and sit down. I went back and sat down and I listened. And the next night Al said, we're going out of town tonight. We're going over to the Preston Group. I love the Preston Group. That's where the rich alcoholics went. Lincolns and Cadillacs, you know, and Suburbans and all this stuff. I mean, it was really, you know, uptown. And so we get up there and we get a cup of coffee and we sit down just as the meeting starts and the guy reads the preamble and I look up and lo and behold, the fellow says, I don't want to go into a long drunkalog. The next night, Al comes by and he says, we're going to Wynn Oaks. And I get to Wynn Oaks. We're about 10 minutes late and the guy's already up to 1929. Saturday night, Al says, look, we're going to do something different tonight. We're going to an Al-Anon anniversary. I say, phew. Thank God, I don't have to go over there anymore. We get to the Al-Anon anniversary, and we get us a piece of cake and a cup of coffee, and this little old lady gets up and says, I don't want to take my husband's inventory, but he had his first drink in 1924. And, Monday night, we went to another meeting, and this guy gets up, and he talks, and he talks, and he talks, and finally we left, and I said, Al, you know, that guy's beginning to make sense. I enjoyed that. And he said, thank God, I don't believe I could have sat through that again, you know. But, you know, things began to make sense to me. I began to see things, you know. Al said, there are two things that every alcoholic has within his character that he must get rid of. Justification and rationalization. And as long as you can justify your actions and rationalize away what you've done, you'll continue to do them. I didn't understand that real well. One Sunday morning, I was sitting in the Arlington group waiting for a meeting to start, and the phone rang. And a guy motioned for me to pick up the phone, and it was a lady on the other end, and she said, I'm drunk. You ever notice how we like to call people and tell them that? I'm drunk. I used to call from California, you know, tell them, I'm drunk. You know, if I'd have just waited, they'd hear about it in 2 days, you know, because it always seemed to spread around. The man said, I'm sorry to hear that you're drunk, said you were doing so well. She said, well, it's the peanut butter. He said, lady, you got drunk on peanut butter? She said, you don't understand. We don't have any peanut butter. My husband came home and threw a fit about the peanut butter, and I went down to the 7-Eleven store, bought me 2 6-packs, and drank all 12 of them. And he said, lady, wouldn't it have been simpler to have bought a jar of peanut butter? And she said, to heck with him, I don't care if he never gets any more peanut butter. Now, you know, we laugh about that, but I wonder how long that lady had to wait for him to throw a fit about something so she could go get drunk. How many times have you got up and started a fight so you could slam the door and go out of the house and have a drink? How many times have you ever called your wife or your husband and said, honey, I'll be 4 days late? Think I'm going to go out and screw my head up for a few days. I may sleep with a few people, you know. I may wind up in jail or the hospital, but don't worry about nothing. I'll be home. You've never seen an alcoholic do that in your life. They call and say, honey, I had a good day at the office. Don't stop off and celebrate. Honey, I had a terrible day at the office. I got to stop off and have a couple of drinks. Joe's sick. We're going to have a drink. Joe's well. We're going to have a drink, you know. I just got a raise. Going to have a drink. I didn't get a raise. Going to have a drink, you know. Didn't make any difference. You know, I got drunk one time 3 days for National Pickle Week. It really didn't make any difference. And I came to believe that there really was, you know, there really was a power greater than I was that could restore me to sanity. I never had any problems with the insanity part of the program. My wife used to say to me, you know, I mean, I used to say to her, honey, don't let the neighbors know I'm drinking. And she'd say, well, how must I explain you being naked out in the yard? And I'd say, tell them I'm sick. I didn't mind being crazy. I just didn't want to be known as a drunk. Let me tell you something. I came to believe that there was a power greater than I was that could restore me to sanity because I saw him do it. I had tried everything there was. I had been to the psychiatrists and the marriage counselors and the preachers and the priests. I tried to join the Catholic Church. I really did. I went down and applied to join the Catholic Church in San Diego, California, and a very understanding priest said to me, why do you want to join the Catholic Church? I said, I want to belong to something that I can come to and be forgiven on Saturday. And he said, you understand that by confession, you're implying that you don't intend to do it anymore. And I said, heck, I got that good a deal where I'm at. If I don't want to do it anymore, they'll forgive me where I'm at. I went to every place I could think of. My wife put me in hospitals. The state put me in hospitals. The police put me in hospitals, you know. And nothing seemed to work. I remember my wife took me to a psychiatrist in White Settlement, Texas once, and he said... I'll never forget this poor little guy. He said, I'm going to put you on Anabeats. I said, oh, what's that? He said, it's a pill. I like that. I like pills, any kind. It don't matter. I'd take mine or yours. It didn't matter. You know? I don't think anybody in the world's ever any more surprised than I was when I found out what my doll really was. I thought it must be a powerful drug because my sister kept it hid. Yeah. He said, I'm going to give you these pills, and if you drink, you'll get deathly sick. I said, I already get deathly sick when I drink. He said, you mean you know you're going to get sick and you drink anyway? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, I don't understand that. I said, I don't either. And he charged us $55 and sent me home. I took the pills, I got drunk, and I did get deathly sick. I stayed in the hospital about 3 weeks. We went to the marriage counselor. We went to the preacher. We went to the doctors. We went to the lawyers. We went to the courts. We went to state hospital. I woke up in a state hospital in Terrell, Texas. And I remember asking the attendant, I said, is this the insane asylum? And he said, no, this is the alcohol ward. You have to stay here 2 weeks before you can go to the insane asylum. They wouldn't even let me in the asylum until I sobered up. And so I looked around AA one night and I saw people like me and like you that had not had a drink in months and years and 10 years and 15 years, and I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt there had to be some supernatural power greater than we were because all the earthly power I had tried and it didn't work. I've always believed in God. I never had the courage to be an agnostic. I thought, like most of you do, that God was what had been described to me from some pulpits by some very bitter, harsh men. my concept of God was given to me by a very straight-laced grandmother, by a mother who was a God-fearing woman in her way, and by a couple of three very bitter, harsh pastors who said to me, just don't. That's all, just don't. And as I look back, I don't remember ever hearing any love of God preached. I was supposed to love him, but if I didn't do what he wanted to, he wouldn't love me. I was supposed to be good, and I was supposed to reach out to him, but if I ever fell short, he was going to step on me. I remember as a little boy walking home from church in the country expecting every bush to burst into flame. I'd walk in the middle of the road, and I'm serious. They talked about sins that could not be forgiven, and I didn't know what they were. I knew one thing, I probably was going to commit them, because I'd already done everything I could. I know now that there is a sin beyond forgiveness. It's the blaspheming of the Holy Spirit of God, and no way would I do that. But you see, one day in Alcoholics Anonymous, a very kind man said to me, look, son, step three says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Now, that does not mean God as we want to make him be. That means God, as we understand what he wants us to be, will give us the strength to do it. And I became very comfortable. I became very comfortable with the God relationship that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, one day they told me that I could pray sitting straight up in my automobile. One day a man said to me, God loves you. If God didn't love you, you wouldn't be here. You don't even know what you've done. You don't even know where you slept a lot of nights. You don't even know how you got from one place to the other. How could you possibly doubt the love and the compassion of God? I could go on and tell you that I just jumped up one day and did a four-step inventory. Wasn't nothing to it. Yeah, sure. I had a friend in prison. He was in AA. He should have been in AA. If he'd been in AA before, he wouldn't have been in prison to start with. I went over to see him. And I said, I'm having trouble with step four. And he said, well, I'll help you. Take this piece of paper, draw you a line down the middle, on one side write good and on the other side write bad. I did, and he said, now, I want you to put down there is absolutely nothing wrong with me on the good side. Well, I believe that. It was kind of embarrassing to put it down. But if he said it, it was all right. And I wrote it. He said, now on the other side, write, I'm a dead burn liar. That's bad. Now you've got your inventory started. Go home, finish. And you know, I found out something. I was neither the best nor the worst. I was pretty average. For every good thing that I had done some bad things. And for every bad thing I had done, I had offset with some good things. And I was a pretty average Joe. You know, I was not a wicked sinner. I was an alcoholic who had done some wicked, sinful things. But God could forgive me. Step three said that. My program tells me that God would forgive me. That he has forgiven me. And so then we came to step five, admitted to God, ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs, and that wasn't any problem at all. I told my sponsor, I said, I'm going down the market and get me a wino and buy him a bottle of wine, and I'm going to tell him this stuff. And he said, no, you're not, because it won't work that way. You've got to tell it to somebody you respect. You see, I understand tonight that step five is done for three reasons. You admit to God for forgiveness, to yourself for understanding, and to another human being for humility. That is the beginning of growth in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You admit to God for forgiveness, to yourself for understanding, and to another human being for humility. You cannot feel superior around somebody that knows all about you. And then they threw step six in there, and I decided I didn't want to do it. It says we were entirely ready to have God remove all our defects of character. When you throw in entirely and all, that's too much. I only had one fault. I had a little temper. I don't anymore, but I used to. Sure, I'm glad my wife's not here tonight. One day I came home from work, and my son was lowering the lawnmower wheels. It was one of those you had to take the axle out and move it down one or two holes, and each wheel came down separately, and he had three down and one stuck. And he had a vice grip plier and a pair of fit-all wrench and a sledgehammer, and he was banging on that thing. And I'm the most unmechanical fellow in the world. I just found out the other day light bulbs screw both ways. You know, I mean, really, you know, inanimate things are against me. They just don't work for me. But I come in my infinite way and say to him, let me do it. And so I reach and grab the wrench and the plier, and the first thing that happened is the wrench slipped off and my hand went into the blade, peeled the meat back to the knuckles, and I, you know, calmly picked up the little sledgehammer and beat the motor off the lawnmower. And I looked up, and my wife and daughter were standing in the door of the laundry room, and she said, good afternoon, Mr. Serenity. And I said, I'm not going to let this thing upset me, and I threw the thing through the garage door. And then I went down to the department store, and I paid $99 for a little lawnmower, and I paid $139 for a new garage door, and it suddenly dawned on me that I could no longer afford to have the temper that I had. And so I became entirely ready to have God remove it. And I believe as I stand here tonight that as these things become a problem in your life, you will be entirely ready for God to remove them, and it will not happen instantaneously. But as they become painful, you'll be willing to give them up. And step seven says, we humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. All that says is you do the asking and let God do the removing. It won't work any other way. And then they told me to make a list of everybody I'd harmed, and I did. And then it said, make amends to such people, except when to do so would injure them or others. Well, I did everybody but one fellow. I had stolen some money from him, and he took my house away from me, and I thought we was even. So I didn't put him on the list. And you know something? My whole AA program went sour. I had a little trick that I used in those days. I went home and went to bed when things went bad. Sometimes I'd stay 2 or 3 days. I was in the hospital 7 times the first year I was in AA. They'll sympathize with you up there. I had Blue Cross Blue Shield through where my wife worked, and I'd just go up there and go to bed. You know, one day I got sick, and it, like, scared me to death. Al came over one day, and he said, get up. And I said, I'm sick. And he said, the whole world knows that. Get up. And then we had one of those famous conferences around my dining room table. The only thing they ever served in my dining room in those days was meat. Al said, there's somebody you haven't made amends to. And I said, if I go back there, they'll put me in jail. He said, you'd be better off sober in jail than you would drunk on the street. And my little boy was about 16 years old at the time. And he said, Daddy, I'll go with you. And we drove from Texas to Georgia. And I went up to see a man to make amends. And when I walked into his office, he said to me, I've heard that you're getting your life straightened out, and I'm proud for you. And I said, you may not be so proud when I tell you what I've come to tell you. And he reached in his file drawer, and he pulled out a ledger, and there was a page marked with a paper clip, and he pointed to it, and he said, is this what you mean? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, I've always known that. I said, I don't have the money to pay you. He said, that's all right. You just go ahead and you keep up the good work. And boy, did I like that. I went downstairs and got in the car, and my boy was sitting there, and he said, Daddy, what happened? And I said, well, I told him, and he forgave me. And he said, but Daddy, what about paying him? And I said, I don't have to. And he started crying. And he said, Daddy, all your life, you've made a practice out of trying to get something for nothing. And if you get away with this, you'll do it again. And I climbed out of the car and went back up those steps. And I said to that man, I don't know how, but some way I've got to pay you back. It was over $5,000. We got in the car and we started home, and we stopped in Jackson, Mississippi. That was where we had lived a day or two in one of my geographical tours. And my son turned off Interstate 20, and I said, why are we stopping here? And he said, Daddy, there's a man here you owe some money to. And I said, I don't have any money. And he says, Mama gave me a check. And she said, if you did the right thing in Georgia, we were to stop and pay this man here. And if you didn't, it wouldn't make one bit of difference. My whole family went to work and paid that man back. My little boy used to deliver papers. And he'd bring the money and give it to his mother, and he'd say, this is for Daddy's ninth step payment. It took us 5 years to pay it back, but we paid every dime of it. And I realized for the first time that I had a wife and two children that really loved me. And you know what I did? I went down to AA, and I sat down, and I worked these steps, and I went to them meetings, and nothing happened. Absolutely nothing. One Saturday afternoon, I was sitting in the club when they were getting ready to have a bingo game, and I got mad because they were laughing. They were having a good time. Some of them folks hadn't been there near as long as I had, and they were laughing, and they were having a good time, and it made me mad. I went down to see Al, and I said, Al, I want to ask you a question. When is something good going to happen to me? And Al looked at me and he said, maybe you're one of those folks that good things just don't ever happen to. And I believe that. I believe that I was that rare exception that no matter what I did, nothing good was ever going to happen. And Al looked at me and he said, Ray, I want to ask you something. Where do you sleep these days? And I said, I sleep in the king-size bed in my master bedroom with my wife. Why? He said, huh? Ray, how are your children? And I said, Al, there's so many kids hanging around our house that sometime I have to go to the service station to use a restroom. And he said, huh? How are things at work, Ray? And I said, I've been promoted. I'm head of the department. He said, huh? How did you get down here today, Ray? And I said, in my new car. And he said, huh? Ray, I hope that someday something good happens to you. And you know something? I left Al's office and I went down into a little park in Irving, Texas, and I sat down under a pecan tree for about 3 hours, and I guess people must have thought I was crazy, and I didn't care because I cried. I cried at how dumb and blind I really was. I sat there and I thought about the night that my wife had invited me to go to the voice recital. She insisted that I go, and when I got there, it was my daughter. 15 years old, and she sang in 5 languages, a beautiful operatic soprano voice. And I didn't even know she could sing. And I cried. I thought about my son who had taken the change out of his pocket the night I went to AA for the first time. And he went up to the phone booth on the corner and he called his grandmother in Kentucky. And when she answered the phone, all he could say was, Mom, my daddy don't drink no more. I thought about the night my son graduated from high school. He graduated in Irving Stadium where the Cowboys play. And there must have been 10,000 people there. And I looked around and I thought, all of these people are here because they've expected to be here.
And I was there because I had been invited personally by a son that was no longer ashamed of his father. I thought about my son, who by this time was in the Air Force in Germany. He was a Mars operator, and he used to call me once a week on the overseas network. Everybody could hear on the shortwave radio from Texas to Germany, and he never hung up the telephone without saying to me, "Daddy, I love you, and I'm proud of you." I thought about my mother-in-law. I had the sweetest mother-in-law that ever lived, and she was the only human being that never gave up on me. And she wrote me a letter right after I came into AA, and she said, "Ray, I've just found out that I have terminal cancer. They're giving me cobalt treatments, and I'm not afraid to die. But I'm frightened when they put me in the cobalt room." And she said, "I spend my time in that room praying for you and your problem." I was devastated. I was feeling sorry for myself because I couldn't drink, and she was dying and praying for me. I got a plane, and I went up there, and she looked at me, and she said to me, "Ray, I don't know why God has spared you, but he has." I never saw her alive again, but I never forgot those words. I decided I ought to go back to church. I didn't like it. Certainly wasn't as much fun as AA. And I made the mistake of telling my pastor one day. I said, "You know something? Y'all don't have near as much faith down here as we have at AA." And God love him, he said to me, "Ray, if you think God has given you something that we don't have, why don't you bring it to us?" Four days later, I was sitting in my room, and I had the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous in one hand, and I had my Bible in the other, and I looked over, and all of a sudden, in letters that big, I read, "We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him." And I looked over in my other hand, and it was open to the ninth chapter of the book of Acts, which is the account of St. Paul's conversion on the road to Damascus, and I was frightened. And I said, "God, surely not that." And it was so plain that God had a vocation for me. And I walked into the den, and I said to Faye, "I believe God has called me to preach." And she said, "What and to who?" Because, you see, it wasn't unusual for me to come up with some pretty weird ideas in those days. And Faye looked at me, and she said, "Ray, I married you 17, 18 years ago, for better or worse." And she said, "So far, it's been worse. But if you think God has called you to preach, then you have a responsibility to prepare." I said, "I want to go to school." And she said, "You should." And I said, "Okay." I called to find out when the next class started, and it started in 12 days. And I began to rush around to get things, and I called a friend of mine in the real estate business, and I'm going to wind this down. And she came over, and I said, "I want to sell my house. I'm going to preach." And she said, "What?" And I said, "I want to sell my house. I'm going to preach. I'm going to Southwestern Seminary to prepare for the ministry." And she said, "Well, we'll put it on the market." I said, "You don't understand. I'm going this week. I need to sell my house today." And she said, "That's impossible." I said, "Don't talk to me about this. Talk to God. It's his plan, not mine. You see, I believe things like that could happen." And she said, "Well, is there anything else that you and God have decided?" And I said, "Yes, I need cash." And she said, "Will that be all?" And I said, "Yes, I want to sell it furnished." At 1 o'clock that day, we signed a contract with a young couple who had just moved into town from New Jersey. And they bought our house for cash and took all our furnishings. And we left with a king-size bed, a color TV set, and a Datsun automobile, and I went to school. I got out of school. We moved to Beeville, Texas, where Faye was working for South Texas Children's Home, and I didn't want a big church. I didn't want to start out large. I thought First Baptist Dallas, you know, or maybe maybe I could be Billy Graham's assistant for a year or two, you know. I didn't have anything. You know what? I just didn't have a lot of people flocking over there for me to come. And yeah, it began to dawn on me, you know, here you are. You're 30-something years old. You're a recovering alcoholic. You know, a newly ordained preacher. No experience and very little intelligence. Almost no knowledge. And I did what I always did in those days, and I still do when I get depressed and in trouble. I went to AA. 310 South Adams Street in Beeville, Texas, was where the AA group was, and I went in, and there was a little man sitting over in the corner. I know now he was praying. I didn't realize he was sitting with his back to the door. And I walked over to the coffee pot, and I turned around, and the little man was standing there with his hand out. And he said, "My name is Carr P. I'm an alcoholic." And I said, "My name is Ray Vowell, and I'm an alcoholic." And he said, "What do you do, Ray?" And I said, "Well, I'm a Baptist preacher." He said, "Where do you preach?" I said, "Well, I'm at large." And you know, the funniest thing happened. Tears began to run down Carr's face. And he said, "Ray, my brother-in-law is pastor of the Calvary Baptist Church. He's 78 years old, and he's had a heart attack. And the doctors have told him that he can't preach anymore. And we've had trouble getting somebody to come down here to this little town. And I came over here today to just pray that God would send us a pastor." And I stayed at Calvary Baptist Church for 5.5 years as their pastor. Everything good that's happened to me has been given to me by God through AA. I could go on and on and on and tell you things that have happened, but let me sum it up by saying this. A year ago this month, I turned 50 years old. God knew how dumb I was, and so He gave me a birthday that I couldn't forget. My birthday is 1-2-3-4. January the 2nd, 1934. I never have forgotten. Four years ago, I said to my wife one day, "You know, I would like to have a doctorate." And she said, "Why don't you go back to school?" And I said, "Honey, I'd be 50 years old before I finished." And she said, "In 4 years, you're going to be 50 either way." And do you know something? She was right. But on May the 18th of 1984, I received my Ph.D. in counseling. And then on October the 15th, God granted us the sweetest, prettiest little boy you've ever seen for a grandson. And I firmly believe, as I stand here tonight, that I owe every one of those things to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because without you people in this program, I wouldn't be here to enjoy it. Without the God that you helped me find in this program. And I'm firmly convinced tonight that God has a special place in His heart for alcoholics. I'm going to prove it to you and shut up. The prime prerequisite of an alcoholic is one word: more. We want more of everything than anybody else. You know, I never had much experience with women, because when I walk into a bar, I didn't want one of them, I wanted them all. And by the time I'd made a choice, somebody already had all of them and was gone. I tried to drink everything I could get my hands on, and I'm still trying to eat everything. I'm trying to do something about that now. But I want you to know this. If you've got any doubts that God truly has a special, special compassion in His heart for alcoholics, you look at what He did. He knows how we are. He gave the whole world 10 commandments, and He gave us 12 steps. because he knew we wouldn't be satisfied with what everybody else has got. And I'll tell you something, we're living up to our 12 a whole lot better than they are their 10. If we don't, we don't smell good. I'm no expert in AA. All I am and all you see tonight standing here before you is God's grace applied to what I used to be. My program consists of two very basic, simple things. Number one, I know which drink makes me drunk. It's that first one. And number two, I know who with God's help has the choice over whether or not I take it. And that's me. Thank you for letting me come.
I'm sure that I speak for everyone here tonight, Ray, and saying thank you. Thank you for sharing with us a true American success story. And it is that, as far as I'm concerned. Any alcoholic that can say, I haven't had a drink today, is a success and a miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, Ray. I think I might make a little explanation. Some of you may have seen me slipping around with this green book in my hand. I've passed quite a few out since I've been here. It's Bill Wilson's biography. Pass it on. You've probably noticed that it's being released. I was in Macon Thursday, and I picked up a case of them and brought them with me. And I asked Lillian about selling them at the desk, and it seems that there's Pine Mountain, you're not allowed to do any selling, so I've had to bootleg them. Sure that each of you will want a copy. Joe, do I turn this back to you to wind up? Thank you again for allowing me to share in this program. It's been a special pleasure for me. And since I assume that Joe said wrap it up, I'm going to do that in the usual manner. Those of you that know me and meet me down in Macon probably expect me to pass a basket, but they told me I couldn't do that tonight since this was paid for. So let's join hands and close with the Lord's Prayer.